This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today, we're interviewing Ranger Ryan Drimbath of Cuyahoga Valley National Park, just a few miles south of Cleveland, Ohio, and Lake Erie. Ryan Drimbath is the ranger biologist at Cuyahoga Valley National Park, where he's worked for the last 7 years. Ryan holds a degree in wildlife and conservation biology from Ohio University, an MS degree in biology from the University of Akron, and he's currently completing his PhD in integrated biosciences. Also at University of Akron. Ryan has the honor of being the only ornithologist to ever hold a living northern parula and cerulean warbler hybrid, which he discovered in Deep Lock Quarry 10 years ago, with a second bird found at Oak Hill in 2015. His most recent project is focused on freshwater mussel restoration in the Cuyahoga River. So welcome, Ryan. It's great to be talking with you. How are you doing?
Thank you. I'm great. It's great to be with you today. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about Cuyahoga Valley National Park. It's close to the urban area of Cleveland and Akron, and it's an unusual location for a national park to be so close to urban areas.
So Cuyahoga Valley National Park, it is a unique place relative to the network of parks that we have in the National Park Service. We were designated originally in 1974 as a national recreation area, and this came out of a local effort as well as congressional effort to preserve the land between Cleveland and Akron. We continue to see urban sprawl and development through that area. There was concern of losing that area, which had been treated not officially as parkland, but used like parkland for recreation from those urban centers. At the same time, prior to our designation, something that helped motivate Congress to commit to this was an effort called Parks to the People. So instead of the idea of having these big Western parks that families have to take these immense road trips to get to, let's bring the national parks closer to more densely populated areas and provide that service. So, or provide that opportunity. So again, yeah, we preserve the land between Cleveland and Akron. It's the Cuyahoga Valley, just like our name. So the Cuyahoga River is pretty infamous. The key feature of the park that runs north-south through the park, about 25 miles of river. The resources that really drove the designation were centered around a lot of our cultural resources. So the Ohio and Erie Canal, which I think we'll talk a little bit more about later, the towpaths and those cultural resources, as well as that preservation of what we call now the rural landscape. So this land between the main cities, folks would come out, drive their vehicles around, enjoy the Argarian rural farming communities as a place for respite. So preserving that was a large part of the motivation that we had. We were renamed as a national park in 2000. So went from a national recreation area to a national park. And the name change is symbolic, but part of an effort in identity, really. The Forest Service has national recreation areas. The National Park Service manages recreation areas as well. But to stand out and make sure the public understood that we were part of the national park system, we got a name change in 2000. Strangely, we are, and not surprisingly because of the amount of people around here, we are annually, in the top 10 most visited national parks. So it's kind of an interesting situation. We get a lot of visitors, a lot of local youth, but a lot of national, people traveling through, stopping in.
What are the principal features of the park that people come to see?
So there's a lot of outdoor recreation opportunities here. So if anybody's interested in learning all about our key resources, you can find our foundations document. So this goes through and identifies our core fundamental resources and values. So as I mentioned, the cultural resources of the Ohio and Erie Canal and the towpath associated with it, those are cultural resources, but we have sort of modified them in a manner in which they support recreational use. So biking, hiking alongside the river with great opportunities to observe nature. In addition to the Cuyahoga River, we have 30,000 acres, over 30,000 acres. About 5% of that is privately owned. We don't own every acre, but we have local metro parks that own portions within our congressional boundary. So mainly forested, second growth forests, lots of hiking trails, over 125 miles of rivers and river and streams, so about 25 miles of the Cuyahoga River, and then a whole bunch of streams that come in, wetlands, and yeah, you mentioned on one of your questions later, I believe, the Cuyahoga Valley Scenic Railroad. That's another thing that brings people to the park. So the recreational opportunity here at Cuyahoga Valley is very unique and diverse. You can ride a train, you can ride a bike, you can paddle a kayak. You can actually do all three in one trip, right? You can paddle your boat and then ride your bike back to your car or take a train ride back to your car. So the recreational opportunities are immense. The natural resources you can experience, wildlife, fish, birds, are also great.
Can you put a raft or a kayak on the river and float along the river?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So people think of, remember the Cuyahoga River for catching on fire? That was a long time ago. And today, we do still have some issues with water quality due to combined sewage overflow. But on most days, the river is great. It's safe to paddle. And along the way, you can float down and see all sorts of wildlife. It's a pretty tame river. It does meander and have a lot of woody, features. But no rapids, and it's a nice float.
So I saw from the website that there's a restoration project going on. So I gather that the area was somewhat degraded at some point, and it's being restored now.
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of restoration going on. So the Cuyahoga River, again, caught on fire a few times. Industrial input and sewage inputs really did a lot of damage to the biological integrity of the system. We still have stormwater issues causing erosion, but the reality is we've seen significant improvements. So we are still within what's called an area of concern, due to the variety of impacts of our industrial past. But currently, we have a couple of restoration projects. The biggest project we completed was in 2020 when we removed the Brecksville Dam. So that opened up over 20 river miles. So there's over 44 river miles of the Cuyahoga River that is now connected to Lake Erie. So that was a huge win for our restoration and goals of being delisted as an area of concern. But another project we've been working on with the Army Corps of Engineers is a river, what we'll call elongation. So in the process of building all this infrastructure in the Cuyahoga Valley, roads and railways power line right-of-ways, the river has actually been intentionally made shorter, cut off. Right. So instead of having to build two bridges, if you just channelize that river, you can build one bridge or maybe no bridges. But a lot of processes have led to the shortening of the river. At the same time, as we know, climate change is affecting our globe. And here, the way we experience that has been increased rain. Overall rain, annual rain, increasing by almost 3 inches over the last few decades, but also that storm intensity. Mm-hmm. So as a result, we know rivers respond to the input, and our river wants to get wider it wants to get longer to balance out all those forces, but it doesn't have the space to move. So the Army Corps led a research study guiding us towards, you know, solutions for improving this river. And one of those key restoration opportunities would be helping the river get longer, right? So we're hoping to add over 1,500 linear feet of stream to the Cuyahoga River, starting in the next few years. That's not going to get it to where it wants to be, to equilibrium, but it starts it down that path. Right. The first site is actually what we're using the term reanimating, so bringing back the old river channel where it was cut off in the past. So we're really hoping that that'll take us in the right direction to start dealing with some of the erosion issues elsewhere and just provide additional habitat for fish and wildlife. In addition, to that construction reanimation project, there's species reintroductions that are going on. So the river has recovered naturally, and fish have come back, right? The fish populations are rebounding and have rebounded naturally on their own. They've had great sources of tributaries where they could have found refuge and still connected to Lake Erie. So a lot of the fish species, smallmouth bass, white suckers, northern hogsuckers, some really cool fish, have come back to the Cuyahoga River. But other species and groups, functional groups, are absent. So freshwater mussels are one of those. Within the 25 river miles in the park, you know, we historically had robust, diverse freshwater mussel beds. We don't anymore. We have searched high and low. And while we can find a mussel or two here and there, it's pretty rare, but we can find one or two every couple of years. We no longer have mussel beds. So we've been working with local partners and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and others to do a freshwater mussel reintroduction project. So we started translocating some mussels last year, but currently we're working with Genoa National Fish Hatchery. They're propagating thousands of fat muckets for us to be reintroduced into the Cuyahoga River to establish freshwater mussels once again. And that's just one species. Our goals are, you know, we're playing the long game on it. You know, imagine it'll be decades of work to restore to what they previously were. But just putting things back that don't really have the ability to recover themselves. So the water quality has improved greatly. The habitat's great. Based on the Ohio EPA standards, most of the park is what's called exceptional warm water habitat. So it's there.
So mussels contribute to the clarity of the water?
Yeah, mussels provide tremendous ecosystem services, right? So where we're at in this project right now, it's the National Park Service. Our goal is to restore the species that were native to this land, right? So when they're gone, we're kind of at this phase where we just want to get these groups, these taxa, back in the river. And as we increase the number of mussels and we develop these mussel beds, we expect to get the ecological benefits of mussels. Mussels are going to filter particulates from the water column, and they move that into the substrate, right? So they're supporting a food web of benthic macroinvertebrates, bringing nutrients from the water, the suspended nutrients, into that substrate. They also can help stabilize the riverbed. So instead of loose sand, silt, and pebbles getting washed away, they can help stabilize those substrates. But yeah, a lot of ecological benefits. They're a food resource for other wildlife as well.
So let's talk about other wildlife. How about amphibians and butterflies?
We have a lot of amphibians and butterflies.
What form of amphibians? Are they frogs or toads or what?
So we have, I want to say maybe 8 frog species, around 8 salamander species. So, sorry, again, I'm missing the number, but we have a diversity of frog and salamander species. Some of the most interesting are the spotted salamander and Jefferson salamander. These are the ones that migrate in mass to vernal pools throughout the park in the spring. They're accompanied by wood frogs, spring peepers. A little later on in the season, we start to see the American toads coming through. But with the diversity of wetlands that we have, from forested wetlands to mixed emergent marshes, there's habitat for just about every amphibian that you might find in Ohio, except for some of the specialized species. So yeah, diverse amphibians, populations. And the butterflies, I'm not a butterfly expert. We do have one of the longest running citizen science butterfly monitoring projects at our park. So there's a statewide effort to monitor butterflies. But our site is one of the longest running at over 25 years. So lots of habitat for butterflies from monarchs to skippers and everything else that you butterfly enthusiasts might want to find.
And what kind of birds do you see in the park?
Let me tell you about birds. This is a park for bird lovers, I'll say. You can find almost 250 species of birds here in a given year. Now that's, comprised of about 120 breeding bird species. Everything from the wading birds, like the waterfowl that inhabit the beaver marsh in the wintertime, to neotropical migrants that come here to breed in the spring and summer. It's a great park to observe birds. We even have grassland birds, the former site of the Richfield Coliseum. This is where, as a kid, I went and saw the Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey Circus, the Cleveland Cavaliers played there, basketball. We acquired that land, and in efforts to restore it, because of the soil compaction, couldn't really get trees to grow there, so it turned into a non-native grassland. But grassland birds like henslow sparrows and bobolinks have showed up, and meadowlarks, and it's a really cool sight. So really a lot of bird diversity. We are trying to understand, our value to the bird population. So while it is a very good place to come and see birds, we know that they have challenges when they come to our park. They're a highly fragmented system. We have lots of brown-headed cowbirds, which lay their eggs in other birds' nests and parasitize them. As an urban park, you have a lot of those meso predators, and blue jays and raccoons and things that have some impact. So while we can see that we have habitat and the birds show up, we're still trying to understand how successful they are and what role the populations we find here play in overall conservation and the things we can do to improve their probability of success. So, lots of really cool birds. One of the coolest ones you mentioned earlier in your intro about the Cerulean Warbler, Northern Perula. I'm not like that arrogant and braggadocious where I go around and claim it. I put that in a bio and you read it, and I'm kind of glad because it's funny. So we found the Cerulean Warbler Northern Perula hybrid. I found them back 10 years ago, like you said. They were assumed to be hybrids, that they were capable of hybridizing. They are, sister taxa, are really closely related. And they had been observed, like people had seen them through binoculars and heard what they thought was a hybrid, but I was able to, because I am a bird bander, capture the bird when I saw it and collect some feather and blood sample that we were able to utilize DNA sampling to our DNA analysis to confirm it was a hybrid and the mother was a Cerulean Warbler. Uh-huh. And the dad was a Perula for both of the individuals. And I was just in the right place at the right time. It was really cool. I was studying Cerulean Warblers as one of the species of conservation concern globally, wanting to know where they're breeding here in the park. And I just had been going to the same site twice a week, And the one day I went down there and there was something weird about that bird. And being able to capture it, confirm it was a hybrid, and then observe what it did, its natural behavior, was really, really cool. The first bird that I caught in the first year, it was, it didn't really do much after I caught it. We had a hard time finding it, after a week after I caught it. But, you know, we didn't have any really amazing observations. But the second bird, the following year, it had a female cerulean warbler on its territory with a nest. So I never saw the male, like, giving food or feeding or going to the nest. When I found the nest, they were ready to fledge. But it was clearly in the center of its territory with no other cerulean or anybody other males there. So that female cerulean warbler chose to at least set up its nest within the territory of that that hybrid bird, which was just such a cool observation. And why I made that comment, I had somebody who, no name please, works in a museum setting, gave me a really hard time and harassed me a little bit about releasing the bird after I had captured it, saying that, you know, in order to prove it's a hybrid, we need to be able to study it more or whatever. But I was really excited to be able to release that animal and see how it behaved, what it did, and discover that nest within its territory so we can get a better understanding of, you know, the hybridization processes and what sort of interactions occur following that. So that's a little bit of a tangent for some people who love warblers. That might be exciting to them. For others, maybe it gives you some intrigue. But yeah, lots of birds.
Lots
of birds. Come on down, Cuyahoga Valley.
Hey, Ryan, I'm going to extend this. This is so fascinating. I'm going to extend this for an hour interview so we can keep going, okay?
I'll try for another hour. Yeah, I'll try to be interesting still.
Okay. Well, tell me about owls or hawks or eagles that you have in the park.
Yeah, the eagles are... Eagles have been a really interesting thing here. So, you know, eagles were declining and basically absent from Ohio for a while until the year, drawing a blank, 2000, let's say 2010. I'll just take a stab there. They showed it back up here in the national park. We had a nest. It was a big deal. It still is a big deal. And that nest has been successful for the most part for the last decade. But what we're seeing in our region is that throughout the state of Ohio, especially in the western basin of Lake Erie, has been just a tremendous population growth. So the number of eagles are just going, just skyrocketing right now.
And are they primarily bald eagles or golden?
They're bald eagles, sorry. We don't have golden eagles regularly, but they're not breeding up here. So the bald eagles, yeah, they're doing great. And what we've seen over the last few years has actually been, we shifted to having competition now between bald eagles. So that nest that was doing great and having success, over the last 2 years, it's actually failed. And we have volunteers who go out and monitor this nest. And our best guess on this situation is that it was the eagle on eagle crime, right? So there was another eagle that moved in and wants to take over that nest. And so they killed the young and got in a fight with the adults. And so we've gone from a point where it's like, oh my gosh, we have a bald eagle, to now you see them up and down the river here. And there seems to be so many of them that they're competing. And it's not like you see in Alaska. I'm not trying to paint that picture where there's, yeah, you know, hundreds. But for us, it's been just a good thing to see, where you're just excited to have one, and now, you know, opportunities to experience them are not hard to find.
What kind of owls do you have in the park?
Mainly barred owls and screech owls and some great horned owls. We have a lot of you know, dead standing trees. Some of the screech owls get a lot of attention. They seem to like these sycamore trees with little you know, cavities inside of them along the river. So with the towpath running next to the river, they seem to pick these little holes that get nice sunshine. And you'll just see, if you're going down the towpath and you see a bunch of people with their cameras staring at a tree, it's probably because they're watching the screech owl nest. but yeah, I'd say their screech owl, barred owl might be the more common one. I do see both of them are very comfortable with the more urban areas, and then great horn being less common.
You have some hawks too, I assume?
Oh yeah, we've got red-tailed hawks, Cooper's hawks, red-shouldered hawks, sharp-shinned hawks. We get some kestrels now and again, broad-winged hawks. Basically, you know, the combination and diversity of habitat that we have here, while it is primarily forested, we have a lot of open areas of marshes and grasslands and agricultural habitat for them to go hunting. And I think it's just overall a nice diverse predator community.
Do you have any shrikes or other animals, birds that are coming down from Canada?
We do get northern shrikes from time to time. They're not every single year, but we do have them show up. So if you just look on our eBird records, the thing is we have so many birders out there. It's amazing. This is just a great place for accessing to go birding, that we have really good records when like rarer, less common species do show up. Often we do find them.
And
you asked about, we do get some of those like eruptions of crossbills from time to time and things like that. But yeah.
Do you have any birds that seem to be in decline for any reason?
Yeah. I think we all have a lot of birds that are in decline right now. I think, you know, globally, that's one of the biggest, you know, one of those issues that we have. So I mentioned grassland birds earlier. And so that's an interesting topic, because grassland birds were not present in Ohio historically. But as we converted the land to more open fields and farms, we've seen areas, even strip mine areas, where these grassland birds have moved. While they're declining in the grasslands of central U.S., we do see them showing up here and finding good habitat. We also are seeing, you know, species like the cerulean warbler globally declining significantly since the 70s, but we still have a few of them, you know, here, nothing like it was. We have some records from back in the 50s, and it's just we're nowhere near where we were back then. But for the most part, I would say, I mean, there's like processes going on at multiple scales. If we think about, do we have declining birds? Yes, we have birds that are in decline throughout their range. But are we seeing declines in birds here at the park specifically? I would say we're actually doing better. Like we're hoping that we're seeing populations increase, having more birds present. But that's yet to really be determined. We started a study this past year where we're trying to understand the trends in our forest bird and birds of conservation populations. But we do see ourselves as a place for those species that are declining elsewhere to reliably have habitat in places.
Well, Ryan, we have just about run out of time, so thank you very much. It's been great to talk with you. I'd like to continue it next week. Thank you very much. Our guest today has been Ranger Ryan Trimbath of Cuyahoga Valley National Park in Ohio, just south of Cleveland and Lake Erie. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to js-wilderness.com or kgvm.org and see additional features of our websites. Thanks very much for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.